Welcome to part two of our conversation with Chris Nielsen about Grandma's Haunted House. So you go into this place and you have some education on the history of it, and you know what happened there and the amount of death. Does it immediately have kind of an ominous feel to it as you walk through the door? Is there any sense of, you know, this is going to be peaceful, this may be interesting? Oh. Or is it immediately like, I don't know about this?
So at first it was, so when you walk in the front doors of Edinburgh Manor, it could easily be the set of a horror movie without having to do much to it. There's, you know, paint peeling off the walls from where it's set abandoned for, you know, 3 or 4 years. But, you know, the Midwest in general has got, you know, that humidity thing going on, and really hot summers, really cold winters, that expansion contraction. Mm-hmm. So got this lead based paint's just hanging off the walls, and there's black mold coming up from the basement. And I don't know what's, I know they lost funding and they basically cleared out, but it looks like one can be forgiven for having this like Chernobyl kind of vibe to it, because it was like people just up and left.
Yeah,
like beds were still made, there were still clothes in the dressers. Back when I first went, there was a lot of not so HIPAA compliant stuff hanging out. I have a, you know, I found old brain x-rays and stuff like that.
Wow.
And my initial reaction was like, oh my gosh, this is so exciting, I found my place. Visually, this place is exactly what I need. And it all kind of came crashing down on me. We're filming as we're going through. Cindy, one of the owners, has given us a tour, and we're down in the basement. And it was super ironic, because up until this point, she was telling us about how, you know, she had heard like pops and clicks or something, but nothing like super audible. And she was telling stories about people had seen things. Mm-hmm. But she said she had never really heard anything like a voice. And we are in the dining room area. And if people haven't been to Edinburgh, people who have been to Edinburgh Manor, they know what I'm talking about. The ceiling fans. For those that haven't, the basement's where the first bit of water started coming in, just from natural leaks. And the ceiling fans are all like bent down in these funky claw shapes, because the humidity warped the wood so much that, you know, they're, you know, these just claws from the ceiling. And she's showing us how you can like flip them on and they'll still spin, which is fascinating. But we can't do it for too long, because there's black molds that just kind of flies off of them.
Yeah.
And she's telling us about this, and the tour had to stop because there was this blood-curdling scream, and it just kind of echoed through the hallways. And it was to the point, my camera guy heard it, Cindy heard it, I heard it. We got it on camera, and we all just kind of stopped and we stared at each other. And my brother was actually the first one to break the silence, because he's like, oh, that's cool. That's what we came here for. And my brain was like, oh shit, I'm in here alone with this stuff for 5 days. And that's when it all kind of started tumbling down on me.
Yeah. Any regrets at that moment?
I wasn't quite to the point of regret, but there was definite hesitation. Like that's like head down, full steam ahead mentality was definitely gone. Sure. And I'm not ashamed to admit I was a little bit anxious at that point.
Is it hard to do an investigation at a place with so much activity, with so many lives that went through so much torment and trauma? I would imagine it's just kind of like, you know, it's like flipping through cable channels, you know, back when we used to do that, where it's like,
oh, yeah.
Try and make sense of what the hell's going on any network when every 2 seconds you're pressing the button. I mean, is that kind of what it feels like investigating a place like that?
Oh, yeah. And I think the actual, it's weird to describe it more as a person, but the personality of the manor is one that does not help that situation. So you have all of these unique personalities, and sometimes it's hard to keep track of, you know, who or what. But the way my interactions, and it sounds like a lot of people's interactions at Edinburgh Manor go, is it is just this funky game of cat and mouse the entire time. You'll hear a door slam, you know, upstairs on the far end of the women's wing. And by the time you get there to go check out that sound, you're now hearing what sounds like you know, a locker door slamming down on the ground floor. When you finally get to that, you hear something fall over in the basement. And it's just this hectic, you know, cat and mouse game the whole time. And then, yeah, you add to the fact that you have so many people that, you know, unfortunately died in this place. And I think it's lost a lot with the Edinburgh, like some of the publicity of Edinburgh Manor that, you know, historically it might not have the best, like a long time ago, but recently this was like kind of a happy place. And I had the chance to meet a lot of the former employees, and it was for them a good place to work. So you have this weird combination of kind of the earlier tragedies to the place. Mm-hmm. And that kind of negativity that goes on down in the basement. And, but then you have the people that were, you know, they were kind of happy to be there, and they're sticking around because they want to, because this was their home.
What was the later years like? Like, obviously you have the, you know, more archaic days of things like this, but are you saying towards the end of its life as a place where people were staying had improved greatly?
Oh yeah, definitely. So I'll give a shout out to my buddy Joe, who I used to be an employee there. The last night I was actually working on my documentary. He was, you know, kind enough to give me kind of a relief of being stuck with myself. And he came out with another investigator and his wife. And he was giving me a tour and just talking about what it was like when he worked there and how it was one of those situations where he never came out and said that this was a super happy place and he loved his job, but it was just written on his face when he would, you know, he would talk about some of the old residents that lived there. Mm-hmm. That, you know, he would, you know, he'd go around, and when I was telling him stories about like things I experienced, he would get this smile on his face. Like, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. And, that's just so-and-so. So it was, yeah, very, just so much better. And I think that just is one of those situations where it came with time. We treat people better with mental disabilities now than we did back in the day, where, you know, back then it was, let's just put him in a corner and kind of forget about him. You know, he was so proud of what he did. He was so proud of some of the people when they made, you know, big steps, because it was more or less a living facility for more than mentally handicapped. It went from, you know, asylum of, you know, any sort of mental condition to more of the home for kind of the people who were kind of higher functioning but still needed pretty constant supervision.
Sure.
So when it
was active, obviously your friend had some experiences there as well. What it sounds like you experienced there over 7 days was kind of frightening and, you know, somewhat negative, or I don't know if it was negative or more so just, you know, that's kind of, you know, because it was so out there, you know, that's just kind of how you perceived it. What was it like for those who did work there when it was functional? Were these spirits frightening to them? Were they frightening to the patients or the residents at the time?
I remember some stories of Joe. So on a lot of occasions, it was more like kind of getting spooked by stuff. Mm-hmm. So I remember at one point he was telling a story about he was going around and he was doing training one day, and his little trainee was kind of following him around. He's telling him what to do, and they're going around and doing bed check. And they get to this one room, and it's the blue room for people that know Edinburgh Manor, but at the end of the hall, there's this room, and they call it the blue rooms because the curtains in there are blue and it kind of dyes the whole room a funky shade, but it's one of the more active areas in the manor. And back, you know, when they were employees there, he's, you know, taking around and he has her go check on the guy who's sleeping in this room. And she's, you know, yeah. Okay. So she pokes her head in and he says, she just jumped back. She's like, whoa. And he's like, oh, did you see him naked? Because, you know, occasionally this guy slept naked. And she's like, no, there was a guy standing in the corner. And he's like, well, you have to check on these things. And she's like, no, you don't get it. It wasn't a person. It was just this, you know, tall, dark thing in the corner. And, you know, naturally they go and check and it's gone. But I think it's just kind of one of those situations where you have, you know, people with a haunted house I compare it a lot to them having a roommate that they didn't necessarily sign up for.
Sure.
I think there were just extra patients in this place that they didn't sign up for. And it, you know, kind of spooked them when they would just happen to show up.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's got to be difficult as well, especially if, you know, you have a facility that is haunted and many are having experiences there. But then it is filled with individuals who may have disabilities and may have, you know, legitimate hallucinations that have nothing to do with ghosts, to then try and decipher, did this person over here, and that's not to say that they can't have a paranormal experience either, but then to decipher, well, when is this something that is, you know, something that it's mentally going on with them versus something that, no, they're experiencing it, and the only way you're going to understand it is by understanding the atmosphere.
Oh, yeah. And there actually, there was a good example of that he gave me. So if you go down onto the ground floor and you take a left and you follow it down to the end of the wing, take another left, you get to the end of that section. There's this room. And in this room, in the back right corner, as you come into the door, there's this bed. And allegedly, and there's no documentation on it, but allegedly there was a girl that was raped here. And it's just an area of the manor that has a funky energy to it. Mm-hmm. And Joe's telling me the story of he came in one night because one of the, you know, the residents were, you know, screaming. And he goes in, checks, and they're like, there's a red-eyed demon in the corner, and he's going to get me. And, you know, they're pointing up to that corner, and naturally he's like, well, there's, you know, there's nothing there. And she was like, no, he's going to get me. He's like, listen, you're religious. If you really think it's a demon, you know, just pray it away, and he'll go away. You'll be fine. And he takes off. Well, the next night, another resident in the room, same thing, pointing the corner. Ah, there's a red-eyed demon. And that's one of those situations where maybe the first person had, you know, actually potentially seen something. Mm-hmm. Whereas the second one might have been kind of following suit with a little, I don't know if it's mass hysteria or like kind of a parroting. So my girlfriend's youngest son, he's mentally challenged, and he has this tendency to just kind of repeat things.
Sure.
And I can see how that can almost kind of have been the situation with something was like that, where it's like, oh, the person the night before has said that there's a red-eyed demon in the corner. Now it's my turn to say there's a red-eyed demon in the corner.
Sure. If that person heard it, that's the thing. I mean, right. It's even scarier if they had no knowledge that the other was saying it, you know?
Definitely. And my brain, so it's a large, almost like communal room. So I think there was maybe four or five beds in there.
Okay.
And I think it was just the person like a couple beds over.
Okay. So there was a chance that it could have been heard or overheard the night before.
Right.
Yeah. That's amazing with places like that. Tell me a little bit more about, you had said, you know, in some cases you believe that the ghost boy sometimes makes appearances on your investigations. Do you believe that sometimes during investigations you have him almost assisting?
I've had situations where I feel like he's there, and it's weirdly enough, and this is kind of weird timing for all of it, I hadn't seen or heard from him in actually, you know, quite a while. Like I mentioned, up until this last week, and I was doing a presentation and just threw out the name, and he shows up. And it's always been kind of one of those things where he's been more my buddy. Mm-hmm. But to actually like maybe have him come along and be like, hey, you know, Greg, come here for a second. Can you go get this person for me?
Mm-hmm.
And because I feel like he's going to have a better relationship with them just because of their state, I guess is how you phrase it. The fact that they're both passed.
Have you ever called on him to do anything like that?
I haven't, but I've really been giving it thought lately. I don't know if that's something necessarily he'd be into, because it's one of those like, I mean, if he's not into it, I'm not going to, you know, push him at all. But he's definitely shown interest on, you know, on occasion showing up on investigation. But he has the tendency more to show up in like day to day life. Cause I know he misses the campground, being able to ride around the golf carts and go see the waterfall and stuff.
Yeah.
It's crossed my mind. Cause I know how some people will bring their dog along, and I'm not by any way comparing this little boy to a dog. But it's like that kind of extra set of eyes and ears that are different from ours.
That wraps up part two of our conversation with Chris Nielsen. A big thank you to him for joining us on the program and sharing his experiences with us. And thank you to you for keeping us on the air. We couldn't do this without you. Until next time for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.